This question and answer session with Jack Crabtree and Tim McIntosh was held on day one of Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
David, and you guys can feel free to answer it also. In our group this morning, I was specifically going down a path with regard to what I thought Dostoevsky was saying about freedom of choice and all that sort of thing being so much the focus of what he was talking about. And then along the way in your introduction this morning and a little bit also in our discussion, you talked about Dostoevsky's his early love of socialism and then his aversion to it later on. Can we make a connection to his view of human nature, or between his view of human nature and how he thinks God has created us, and how that is fleshed out in governmental systems? Can we make that connection, or is that too much of a leap, an unwarranted leap, which I like to take every once in a while?
A connection between Dostoevsky's view of man and the form of government that would be appropriate?
Yes. I mean, is there anything in his background and in what he's doing in that book? In Brothers Day, at one point in our discussion, talking about when he's demonizing the Catholic Church, is he demonizing the Catholic Church or is he demonizing the socialists of his day? I don't want to read too much into what he was trying to do in there, but what is there about his view of human nature and the way God created man that would be fleshed out in real life?
That would lead to his critique of socialism?
Pardon?
That would lead to his critique of socialism?
Well, does it lead to his critique of
socialism? Well, I think it does, yes.
And in this book, or just can we read that into what he's doing in this book, or is that a reach?
Well, I don't know if we can read it into what he's doing in The Grand Inquisitor for sure. But there are other things that other statements that Ivan makes that indicate that he is socialist leaning. And Dostoevsky's critique of socialism is, I think, is similar to what he's saying in The Grand Inquisitor, and that is the way you achieve socialism is to take everybody's freedoms away from them, that you reduce them to something less than a human being in order to be able to provide them with the things that they think that they will make them happy. And so it's consistent with The Grand Inquisitor, and that I think that comes out in a number of his works.
In kind of a continuation of the last question before the break, would it be reasonable to say that suffering in the world is a reflection of God's character, in the sense that God, part of God's character is that he suffers, and therefore to know him we must suffer also?
As for me, I don't know. It wouldn't necessarily have to be the case, because I think the meaning of reality in terms of how that reflects on God is in the narrative taken as a whole, the narrative drama of cosmic reality taken as a whole, not necessarily in any given aspect of it. So I think God has created all kinds of stuff in created reality that are not in and of themselves a reflection of who God is. We are male and female. God is not, for example. I don't think we can read sexuality back into God just because he created sexual differences, for example. And likewise, the suffering may play a role and be a foil to what it is in the interplay of the narratives without necessarily in and of itself reflecting anything that's intrinsic to God. But could it be? I guess.
Just before we went for the break, you had said that God is not a nice guy. And taken as an isolated statement, if you tell me God is not a nice guy, scares me to death. Why should I trust him? I think we've come to think of the word nice as being synonymous with good. Someone who's not a nice guy is not at all loving or interested in anything to do with my well-being, and I know you don't mean that. So I was wondering if you could expound a little bit more on what you meant by that.
Well, it's captured in Jesus' parable where there's the guy goes on a far distance and he leaves some talents behind for his servants to use and stuff. And remember, the comment that gets used by the unbelieving one is, "I knew that you were a hard master. You reap where you do not sow." And then in the parable, he repeats that again and says, you rightly say, I am a hard master. That's what I mean.
Well,
what I'm getting at is, from my own standpoint, God is not answerable to me. I am answerable to him. God has purposes that he's accomplishing in the world, and he's created a role for me within those purposes. But what he asks of me and demands of me and expects of me and all that stuff, he didn't consult with me first. You know, he didn't negotiate that with me, and he's not really even answerable to me about what he demands of me. So in that sense, he's not, by nice, I mean concerned that his image in my eyes is that he's soft relative to me rather than who he, just as demanding as he is and having as high of expectations as he has.
I'm not sure that's what's going on in that parable. I think what the master is pointing out is that the servant is being logically inconsistent. If you really believed that about me, you would have acted this other way. You're contradicting yourself. You're just using an excuse. Because the other servants, he doesn't make unrealistic expectations, have unrealistic expectations of them. And also, you've got psalms, like I forget which psalm it is, when the psalmist says, catch my tears in your bottle, are they not in your book? The idea that God does not make us suffer one tear more than is absolutely necessary to create the good, you know, the good purpose that he has every right to create as the creator. So I think there is a sense in which he is a nice guy. I mean, he is not insensible of our pain. He doesn't cause us pain for no reason. I mean, it's always purposive. Towards the creation of what he's doing, and he doesn't make us suffer one tear more than is absolutely necessary to create that. So he's my master. He has a right to ask me to do difficult jobs, but he's not insensible of my pain.
No, and I'm not saying that he is. Let me try again, because I don't think that was the point of that parable either. I was just using that phrase. Children will often scream at their parents, I hate you. You're mean. That is not uncommon. Anybody who's been a parent has had that experience. Now, why are they screaming that? Because I'm placing demands on them that they don't like. Am I insensible to their pain? No. Am I Am I causing them pain that is not necessary? Probably. But am I intending to cause discomfort and pain and sorrow in their life that is not necessary? No. My goal is to parent them, and that sometimes means asking of them and requiring of them something that they really don't like. And that it, from their standpoint, seems mean, seems cruel, seems insensitive. I mean, what they're thinking is, aren't you insensitive to my... To the pain that you're causing me? Well, just because it seems that I'm insensitive to the pain doesn't make it so. And that's what I mean. When I say God is not a nice guy, God is going to place demands on my life, make me go through things that if he were to ask me ahead of time, do you want to go through that? I'm going to say, no, I don't want to go through that. But he's not asking me whether I want to go through it. He's going to take me through it anyway. And that's what I mean, is that. But no, I don't mean to imply at all that he's insensitive to the fact that my suffering is actually suffering. I think he knows full well that my suffering is suffering.
I think also, when I heard you say that, one of the things that comes to mind is God doesn't play by my rules. And he breaks all my rules at one time or another. So in that sense, he's not nice in that I can't put him in a box. Or Lewis's description of Aslan, that he's not a tame lion, but he is good.
So suffering opens me up to the opportunity to investigate what's true and think about what's true and pursue truth. And ideally, the government's responsibility is to make space for me to deal with myself as an individual and allow me to grow up and mature, become an adult. If suffering is that helpful, then why not encourage government to be a government that produces suffering, including the suffering of my being encouraged to be a child and dependent upon the government, because that itself is a kind of human suffering, even if it doesn't feel like it to me. It really is, if I were to analyze it. And I just wanted to see if maybe your answer to this question might be the same as mine, and that is that, but unlike maybe what we think about Jesus and the apostles because of how we have experienced Christian authority in our lives through churches and denominations and throughout church history, Jesus and the apostles were not demanding of people to follow simply because it was important for them to submit to some kind of authority. And I'm not explaining this very well, and that's why I'm part of the reason I'm asking this question is maybe that you can articulate it better than I am right now. But there was a sense of really allowing people to be free to make their decisions, I'll say it that way, by both Jesus and the apostles, which then got distorted and perverted down through church history. So that what we're saying about government is that it really would be best if you would act like Jesus and the apostles and grant people the freedom to make their own choices with respect to all different kinds of issues in their lives, and especially the spiritual issue of coming to grips with themselves as creatures of God. But if you don't, that still isn't going to stop God from working in people's lives, because he can grant people grace and change their hearts regardless of what kind of political structure they're living under. But ideally, it still would be the best kind of environment to live under, nevertheless, would be one that would emulate Jesus and the apostles. Is that
correct? Yeah, that's exactly how I'd answer that. Maybe just to add to that, yes, from God's perspective, you know, he can use any kind of government and any kind of thing, but notice he can use any kind of evil by another human being against me for his purposes. I mean, he can take someone to murder my child or my wife, and that could be very, very productive spiritually in my life. Does that mean we should go out and murder so that grace might come? No. because it's evil to murder. And I would say the same thing about government. I think the reason Jesus and the apostles take the perspective they do is it's evil to turn people into children. It's evil to turn them into animals. It's evil to not respect their individual responsibility before God. So can God use evil governments? Yeah, but I think they're evil governments. Can God use evil churches? Yeah, but they're still evil churches.
I'd like to direct this at someone who's wearing a blue shirt and blue jeans at this time. So, right now, my wife has an expensive back injury where I'm wrestling with, because I have really cruddy health insurance, and we could not pay for it out of pocket, do I have a responsibility as a husband to say the health care system where we are living right now is not going to help my wife, and so I need to find a new one, move to another country that has a different kind of health care system, or try to find an alternative way to pay for this? Or do I say the suffering is a part of God's plan and wait? So I would like both blue-shirted gentlemen to comment on that, please.
So I misunderstood something about this scenario. So your scenario is you can't afford the sort of health insurance that would allow her to get the type of surgery that she needs. And there's nothing in your near financial future that would permit you to have that sort of health insurance. So one solution would be to move to Quebec to get to have some sort of, so that you'd be on a universal plan.
Possibly.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, what complicates it is it's your wife. I mean, if you were talking about yourself, then is it an option to you to say, God has put me in this situation, I don't have the resources to do anything to remedy it, will I just suffer under this? Yeah. Then that would be an option for you. But what complicates it is it's not you, it's somebody else, and having compassion to anybody is important, let alone your wife. And that gets very complicated, because on the one hand, you want her to have a say in it. On the other hand, so I mean, because she could make that decision for herself, but on the other hand, that's where, you know, the whole oneness of marriage becomes very, very complicated. And it's above my pay grade.
Do we need to call in yellow shirts to help with this situation?
does she want to move to Quebec?
Well, it's more of just we have to look at what available options there are and say, what are we going to do? What makes it a challenging thing for me is that even in what we're discussing is, you know, our system is in part built on a reliance on institutions, because we don't take care of each other anymore, really. And so when the institutions fail, what do we do? And that's a very real element in our life right now.
Because I was going to say, I mean, just do an end run about the institutions. Maybe there is a community who'd be willing to share the burden and help.
Anybody else?
This may seem a bit obtuse way to get to your question, but in Matthew 18, when it talks about reproving a brother who has done wrong, and you go to him in private, and then that doesn't work, you go and bring two or three other people, and that doesn't work, you bring it before the whole church, and if that doesn't work, you treat them as a outsider, tax gatherer or a sinner. As I look at the church, at least in my experience, that last option seems problematic. We don't treat sinners and tax gatherers any different than we do the other people that show up at church. And I don't think that the passage is indicating that we should treat them different, that we should persecute or make life difficult for them. We just are supposed to draw back. The problem is that we're drawn back from each other already. It's that we don't treat each other like brothers. And part of that is, I think that we've become accustomed to a system that has provided us with so much that we're not accustomed to relying on each other. So certainly my recommendation is to get together with your church family and make it a problem of the community, not to handle it all yourself. And being as individualistic as probably anybody in the room, that's as difficult for me to say as it is for anybody else. But I think that's the biblical imperative, is that we need to say, hey, are we going to act as, am I part of this body? And what does that mean? Does it have any significance here? And what do you say, elders of the church? Do you think we should be reliant on, on a system? And should we go find a better system in Quebec and see what the Holy Spirit says to a group of people?
Not an answer to your question. Anybody else want to take that one on? Okay. Tim, I was helped today by your mentioning that in our reading that we did, Dostoevsky doesn't answer the question that he raises about evil, but we have to read the rest of the book to kind of get to it. For the sake of some here who won't be reading the rest of the book, can you kind of, and those who are going to can shut their ears, can you unpack it a little bit, maybe what else is said that points us in the right direction?
I think that one thing that I did mention was that Ivan loses his mind or is on the road to losing his mind by the end of the novel. The other thing is the life of Alyosha. Father Zosima dies. Does he die in the reading? Yes. At the end of the reading, he does. And he encourages Alyosha to leave the monastery to take on kind of a secular vocation. Boy, I really am going to give away this book. I won't give away the murder mystery. Alyosha has met a boy who has been estranged and just abused by his classmates. And that boy grows very sick, and all these boys, his classmates, still kind of detest him. And through the narrative of the novel, Alyosha brings all these boys together, and when the boy dies that all these other boys have abused and hurled insults at, they're all gathered at his bedside for his death. And the closing part of the novel is Alyosha speaking to all these boys, reminding them or saying to them, "Remember, you will always remember this time that you started off doing evil to a brother. You did wicked things to him. He died, but now you all came to him in love, and this is the sort of choice that you'll constantly be facing in your life. And even when you make repeated decisions, evil decisions, bad decisions that harm people, you can still look back at this point of your life as a reminder of the sort of person that you would want to be, and you can still be that sort of person." So I see Alyosha is this character who's capable, unlike Ivan, of reflecting God's love to his fellow people, and not just loving them, but encouraging them to love each other. So that's the Alyosha part. The other major part of the novel is the story of Dmitri, the third brother. That's probably too long to go into, and that's why you should read the book, John.
Now maybe I will a little bit more. But in mentioning Ivan going mad, I mean, is that because his worldview doesn't answer the question either about why there's evil? Because it's not only a challenge for the Christian worldview, it's a challenge for the non-Christian worldview. Why is man evil?
I think that it's... I think Ivan has got an intellectual solution that doesn't really jive with the way that life is lived. I mean, I think in a lot of ways it's sort of... I'm not going to say it's watertight. I think it's logically coherent and absolutely unlivable. And I think that's what drives him insane, is that he has got himself into this little bitty logical box with big black iron bars, and he can't get out of it. And that's what drives him insane. Is that an answer to your question?
Sure. Yeah. I'll take it.
Okay.
And Jack, if I could ask you, the tension that we feel between eternal life being about the future versus now, you know, the gospel being relevant now versus later. For me, it's more of a tension. I mean, that it is kind of a both and, rather than it's all now or all later. The way you answer the question, it seems to be a little bit more heavily sided on the all later. I mean, is there still some tension with the relevancy of it now?
Well, I certainly didn't mean to imply that it's irrelevant now. It's not a matter of it, whether it's relevant now. It's very, very relevant now. I mean, Peter uses the word a living hope and talks about joy that comes from that. So it's very relevant now, but in terms of what my humanity craves in terms of a fulfillment of why I exist, I'm not going to find that now. That's what I mean. I think that's all in the future. Now, even there, do we have, and I think that's partly what Dostoevsky is saying, is do we have foretastes of what it's all about? I mean, is loving one another a foretaste of what the kingdom of God is? I would think so. Yeah, so, but is it anything substantive that really finally satisfies our existence? I mean, the problem is every act of love is followed by ingratitude or, you know, something that just kind of saps all the real substance out of the good things that we do here and now in this life. Life has a way of giving with one hand and taking away with the next. I think that's what's not going to be true in the age to come.
So it sounds like I was confusing relevance with fulfillment. Ultimate fulfillment. Okay.
This is a question on the 1 Peter 3 through 9 passage. There's a lot of language in the beginning of that passage that sounds like God is shielding or protecting us until we receive our salvation. I could actually read it because it's pretty short. For God has reserved a priceless inheritance for his children. It is kept in heaven for you, pure and undefiled, beyond the reach of change and decay. And God in his mighty power will protect you until you receive this salvation because you are trusting in him. I guess other translations say it, shielding or something slightly different. But I'm just curious about the nature of that protecting or shielding before we receive the salvation. Is that assuming we've already become a child of God?
Yeah, I think he is. Yeah. I mean, for those of us who have been chosen to that destiny to be his children and to enter into life, yes, he keeps us.
So how, what are we shielded from, or what are we protected from?
The seduction of the world.
So the loss of our faith. Basically.
The loss of our faith, exactly.
Okay. So it's not really anything more than that?
I don't think so.
Mm-mm. Okay. Try to follow up a more straightforward question with a real naughty, rascally question.
The stuff we were talking about, the purpose of suffering, we've mostly touched on the effect, if I'm suffering, its effect for good on me. But can God ask me to suffer for things? It's I think one of the things that we're supposed to learn from Job And one of the mistakes often made in the Christian community is if somebody's suffering a lot, it must be that you are just really intractable. You're hard to teach. You're hard-hearted, and God is really having a hard time getting through to you. So that's what's going on. And I was wondering if you could talk about a correction to that idea.
Yeah, I think God could call upon me to suffer for the sake of other people, and that we're such utilitarians that we think the only way suffering could have meaning and significance and value is if some consequence of it was good. What I would maintain is, no, I think meaning can be, I think suffering can be meaningful and significant in and of itself, in its own right. And because where it drives its meaning in the narrative of my life, not in the consequences of the suffering. I mean, more often than not, there's so many consequences that come from suffering that are basically invisible to us. I mean, we don't even see them. We don't even know. But I think I can still know that my suffering is meaningful, even if I cannot analyze what it produced or what it did or what it accomplished. Those examples of suffering that I alluded to earlier in my life, I couldn't tell you this was really good because A, B, C, D, and E. I mean, I couldn't analyze it, but I came through those knowing that God had somehow changed me.
I think one of the things that happens when people, I like that idea of our problem is a basic presupposition of utilitarianism, that's not an adequate way to look at what's going on with suffering. I hadn't thought about that. That's good. Because I know I found myself sort of trapped in that, and other people I've talked to, and it's you're in the midst of something really excruciating, and you think, okay, if I go only figure out what he's trying to teach me, he'll take his hand off of me. Mm-hmm. And what the heck is it? You know, okay, I'm trying to get it. I'm not getting it. You know, tell me already. And that's not, it sounds like you're saying that's the result of an inadequate view of what's happening with suffering.
Yeah. And the other mistake that's being made there, I think, is that so it's not, suffering doesn't so much teach us in the sense that it informs us of heretofore undisclosed propositions and information and beliefs. Because most of what I learned through the suffering, I already knew before the suffering. What suffering does is not reveal new truths to us. What it does is changes my relationship to those truths. It changes me. Makes me more receptive, makes me willing to invite it deeper into the fabric of who I am or into the commitments of my heart. And it's hard to put that in. I mean, if you ask someone, well, what did you learn through that experience? It always sounds trite when I tell you what I learned, because, you know, I would always respond, what, you didn't know that before? I mean, but it's not a matter of what I learned, it's how I knew it afterwards. I knew it differently afterwards.